Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court is pleased to hear this special argument today at the University of Houston School of Law. And the court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040245, In re Lumberman's Mutual Casualty Company, which is here on petition for writ of mandamus. And docket number 041104, Richard Feist and Stephanie Feist versus State Farm Lloyds, which is here on certified question from the United States Court of Appeal for the Fifth Circuit. Each side has been allotted 20 minutes for these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. The arguments are being recorded and should be available on the court's website toward the end of this week. There is currently one vacancy on the court, and the governor has named Chief Justice Phil Johnson of Amarillo to fill that vacancy. And the court is pleased to recognize Chief Justice Johnson of Amarillo, who is here to review the arguments this morning. Chief Justice Johnson. The court is now ready to hear argument in 040245, In re Lumberman's Mutual Casualty Company.
May it please the court, I thank you for providing the opportunity to appear before you today. The case that is presented here is fittingly argued at this school because it would, the history of this case would make for one incredible law school exam. I, for one, would not want to have to sit for it. I think that a history of the case is important to knowing to understanding the issues and the reason that we are here today. But having said that, there are still only two discrete issues that we present to the court. The first rides on the question of whether a liability insurer is virtually represented by its insured. I would submit that in a non-direct action state, it must be. The Continental Casualty case that we cited to the court does not specifically address the question, but I think that in a situation where the law of Texas would clearly indicate that where the liability insurer must cover the judgment that is rendered against its insured, as is the case here.
Do you think it fits under the current rule of vicarious representation?
Yes, Your Honor, I do, because as I understand, the three prongs of that rule, first you have to show, the most important is that you be bound by the judgment. And there isn't any dispute but that Lumberman's is bound by the underlying judgment.
Has Lumberman's filed a declaratory judgment action asserting non-coverage based on non-cooperation?
No, Your Honor, it has not, for a number of reasons. First off, what is at stake here, the two principles that are in conflict, are the right of the insured to protect itself against what it perceives to be an uninsured exposure, and the right of the insurer to protect its own interests and to control the defense of the litigation. Now, these two principles in this case did not come into conflict until the case was already on appeal. In fact, until the notice of appeal, the deadlines for the notice of appeal had already passed. The appeal taken by Lumberman's insured preserves Lumberman's essential issue in this case, the choice of law issue, from which everything else flows. That notice of appeal covers that. So as of that date, there was no basis for Lumberman's to ever assert that its insured had failed to cooperate.
What about the argument that the appeal wasn't filed timely?
That our appeal was not filed timely?
Or your motion to intervene?
Your Honor, I will freely admit that having been presented with the question for which we have admitted to this court, we can find no precedent. When the issue was squarely presented to us, your dispositive issue was no longer before the Court of Appeal, and the notice of appeal had run, we did not know what to do. So the 6 weeks that we took to determine what are our available options and to land on what we thought was the correct one, which was a motion to intervene, I would point out that that decision was so far been wrong. What we concluded was our method of proceeding has been denied by the Court of Appeal twice.
Well, you say there is no statute, no rule, no direct precedent that would require the Court of Appeals to permit the intervention. So how can we, how can the court say that the Court of Appeals abused its discretion in making that determination?
The argument that we would make, Your Honor, goes to whether it, I understand, and that's the argument made by the opponents, that if you can't cite to a rule, there can't be an abuse of discretion in denying you the relief that you seek. The other is the breach of a legal duty, the other grounds for a mandamus. And the reason that we believe that one or the other must apply is that there isn't any dispute but that Lumbermans has a right involved in this case. There are $29 million at stake of Lumbermans' money.
But the dispute is where to assert that right, because if intervention were not allowed, would you agree there'd be a conflict and that could be resolved separate and apart from the appeal?
If intervention is not allowed, Your Honor, then Lumbermans faces, as I understand the question that the Chief Justice presented to me, which is, do you then institute a separate action against your insured for a declaration of no coverage? And I would respectfully submit that is not a remedy, because while that case is going forward, the appeal at which Lumbermans' property is at stake, the $29 million supersedeas appeal bond, that appeal goes forward.
But could you have moved in the appellate court to withdraw the bond?
Your Honor, according to my understanding, I can't appear in front of the appellate court at all. If I have no right to appear before the appellate court, I don't know how I have the standing to file a motion to cancel the security. And that is what would be required in this case if, in fact, the law concludes that what the insured has done here is a breach of cooperation. I would respectfully suggest as well that I don't think it is. In the cases that we have cited to the court, what the insured did was reach a settlement with the adverse party, and in one of the cases, the insured retained an interest. It assigned rights against its own insurer to the adverse party and then retained a financial interest in any recovery that was made. Now, the insurer took the position that was collusion. I don't believe the issue was ever resolved. But here, we have a situation where our insured has taken this position. We can no longer assert this position on your behalf because it exposes us to a contingent, uninsured judgment.
You'd agree, though, that this is a pretty slippery slope to allow intervention. What sort of parameters would you put on a rule that you're asking us to craft? Only when a bond is posted, only when a settlement's been made by the insurer that protects its interest at the expense of the excess. You know, what sort of parameters would you put on it to keep this from becoming open game for every insurer?
Well, Your Honor, in the first place, I don't think that this is something that would occur often. No one, to our knowledge, has really asked for it before. Ordinarily, these issues come up at an earlier stage in the proceedings. Had our insured refused to assert the choice of law issue at the trial court, I believe that on the law of Texas, we would have had the right to intervene at that point.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is I can envision many circumstances where the insured, as a tactical matter, decides to only limit the issues on appeal to three or four. The insurer then can come up with four or five other grounds for appeal, but it can claim or dispositive when you've got two appeals pending at the same time. Surely you don't want that result. And so under the rule you're advocating, I could see how that could happen.
I could see how that could happen as well, Your Honor. And it is certainly the case that you don't anticipate, you can't anticipate every factual circumstance that may come up. I mean, in this case, it's
and
a textbook example of it.
What parameters would you put?
I would submit that in an instance where the insurer's money is presented as security for the judgment against the insured.
So when a bond has been posted?
When a bond has been posted, the insurer's property is then directly at stake in the proceedings. And if a change or an alteration in the lineup or for the want of a better word, when the insured and the insurer, for whatever reason, break ranks after that, as long as the dispute or the conflict is in good faith, then it seems to me that it is in the interest of the overall resolution of the litigation to allow the party whose interests are at stake to intervene at that point.
So if a bond has not been posted, then you would say intervention should not be allowed?
Well, if the bond has not been posted, then the insurer has not secured the judgment against its insured.
And it's still liable, though, for whatever happens.
In those circumstances, in the event that the insured would then institute an action against its insurer to recover what the judgment was, if the insurer had failed to sustain the judgment. I think that's the point here, though, Your Honor, is that by posting the bond, as opposed to the Connell Casualty case where the insurer tendered its policy limits, by posting the bond, we preserved not only our insurer's right to appeal its issues, but the insurer's right to appeal its issues.
Do you see this as sort of a... intervention is a matter of right, or should there be some good cause burden to carry?
That is the way that we would envision it, Your Honor. Again, understanding that we recognize we're presenting something that the grounds for intervention in the district court we know are more liberal, and intervention is supposed to, as we understand, be allowed of right and then only subject to a motion to strike. And in exceptional circumstances such as this, we believe that the court could craft a remedy allowing an intervention of right, again subject to a motion to strike. If we could not sustain our position that we had a right in these proceedings and that we had secured that right, then a motion to strike the intervention at the Court of Appeal would lie to the same extent that it lay at the district court.
What if there had been no SUNAT-CUD settlement? What if CUD had just decided not to appeal this issue?
Then as I appreciate the law, Your Honor, had they notified us or had we been advised that that issue would not have been appealed, we would have had the right under the Doctrine of Virtual Representation to appear and appeal it on our behalf.
So you wouldn't put a limitation then? I'm trying to cabin in this intervention right. I can perceive a limitation being that the insured has independently secured a benefit for itself at the expense of the excess.
Correct.
As a possible parameter, but your answer would throw that parameter out as well.
As we understand it, Your Honor, the only thing that makes this, what makes this case unique is the timing, is when the right arose. If we are reading the law of virtual representation correctly, at any stage prior to this, an appeal of right would have lain for the benefit of the insurer. It is only because the delays for the notice of that appeal had run that we, at that point, could not file a notice of appeal.
You have, not only the duty to defend, but the right to defend this case?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
So why, when were you, did counsel notify you of the position they were going to take? Didn't you have the right at that point to instruct counsel to put this in the brief?
To instruct counsel to take a contrary position?
Yeah.
Your Honor, I cannot find a case that allows, that extends to an insurer the right to compel its insured to take a position that it believes is adverse to its interests under penalty of loss of its coverage.
But at that point, there was a conflict of interest. And in the trial court, you would have had independent counsel for the insured and counsel for the insurer. Could you do that here?
That is, I think, what we seek to do, Your Honor, by Mr. Tremonti and I asking the Court of Appeal to let us in to represent the interests of Lumbermans, because there is now a conflict of interest presented between the interests of Lumbermans and the interests of its insured.
Since this is an extraordinary remedy, as you indicate that you're seeking, should we require that your client at least attempt with the trial court to change the bond, change the amount, have your insured put up some of the bond? The trial court in Texas does have the ability to even take evidence, hold a hearing to change the bond while the matter's on appeal.
Again, Your Honor,
as you know, there must be no adequate remedy.
To my mind, that the withdrawal of the security and the exposure of the insured to an uninsured judgment that at the time it was rendered was fully covered is extraordinary remedy, or a more extraordinary remedy than to allow a situation where the insurer, presenting only one issue, but the dispositive issue as far as the insurer is concerned, than to allow that insurer to come in and assert only that issue while the insured remains protected against the judgment to the extent that the judgment was covered under the policy. See, again, I come back to the fact that I don't see a situation like this as being one that I understand it presents a collusion element. I would point out to the court an interesting fact. I do not think that it does. I think that when an insured acts to protect its own uninsured interests, it is not being guilty of collusion. It is protecting itself. The attorneys that Lumbermans hires to defend its insured have an obligation to act in the insured's interest, even to the prejudice of Lumbermans.
Well, how's this different from Gandy? In Gandy, we said it was collusion. And this, the only difference from Gandy is they're colluding after the appeal's filed rather than before.
Yeah. Well,
So we were wrong in Gandy, too.
I don't necessarily agree with that, Your Honor. I think that there is a distinction.
I mean, if the insured and the third party get together and decide, you know, we'd like the insurance company to pay for this one. If they do that before judgment, we call it collusion. Why are you scared of calling it collusion after judgment?
Because I think that there is, a conflict between the idea of collusion and the idea of the insured protecting itself against an uninsured exposure.
So it's not collusion if you're trying to save money. If you're doing it, just collusion only arises when you're doing it for pro bono reasons?
Well, no, Your Honor, not for pro bono reasons, but in the circumstance where you have... The counsel representing the insured have come to the conclusion that to continue to maintain a position that has been in good faith taken all the way through exposes our client to an uninsured judgment. We, at that point, have to make a decision. In this circumstance...
Whether you call it collusion or not, is it any different from Gandy?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe that
because
when...
Because the insured there is just trying to protect himself.
Well, the insured, when it reaches a settlement, is with the other party, is always trying to protect themselves. And had Sonat reached some sort of independent settlement, when Cud reached some sort of independent settlement with Sonat that guaranteed it a certain amount of money out of the insured, out of the insurer's proceeds, and as in the other case, retained a right to recoup some of the money back in the pursuit of the insurer, then you would argue that that was collusion.
You have said you'd be bound by the judgment. Are you saying if you are not permitted to intervene here that you have no relief, no other legal avenue to avoid paying that $29 million?
And what I'm saying is, Your Honor, we have no other legal avenue to present to the court, to the courts in Texas, the one issue that disposes of all of our proceedings.
Why couldn't you file an amicus brief?
Your Honor, my understanding is that the issues that have been briefed on appeal are the issues before the Court of Appeal, and...
Amicus briefs filed all the time, sometimes even after argument.
But it wouldn't... I do not believe that under the rules of the amicus brief that we would be entitled to an address in an issue that is not before the Court of Appeal. And the understanding here is that the issue is not before the Court of Appeal.
So what are we to do with Sonat if we adopt your position? They've dismissed their claims with prejudice. Too bad?
Well, that's Sonat's reply to us, Your Honor, is that it's simply too bad. I would point out, if I may finish, I've been told to stop. There are bad cases with bad facts that lead to bad results. In this case, it is interesting to note that there is a proceeding still in the district court in which Sonat has been declared to also be our insured. So if there is collusion in this event, there is collusion by both of the insureds under the policy. Unfortunately, we cannot institute an action to address that, and a declaration of no coverage comes too late if the money posted as security for the judgment has already been lost. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I was struck at the outset in reading the briefs of the insurance company that they devoted not a drop of ink, not a word, to what this court has struggled with over probably 100 years, and that is, when does a mandamus lie? And the test that this court has always pushed forward on both the trial courts and the courts of appeals is, as enumerated in Walker versus Packer, is that it's got to be an abuse of discretion, and that discretion is abused if and only if either the trial court or the court of appeals could have reached only one decision.
What if this had occurred in the trial court? What if this conflict had occurred in the trial court? Wouldn't the insurance company then have had the right to come in and defend?
I think they would have, Your Honor.
So why is it different once we're on appeal?
Well, I think there are several reasons why it's different. One is there is not a single appellate rule that this court has written that ever allowed anybody to intervene long after the trial court's jurisdiction has passed.
Is there a federal rule?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is there a federal rule allowing intervention?
I'm sorry, Justice Brisker, I don't know, sir.
There's not. So how did...
I'm glad that wasn't a quiz.
how in the Pledge of Allegiance case did Ms. Nidal, after her child has become infamous with the Ninth Circuit's opinion, intervene and move to dismiss, and Ken Starr argue at the U.S. Supreme Court when there's no federal rule of intervention?
I think politics makes for some strange rules sometimes, Your Honor.
Well, how about $29 million? That's not enough to make a strange rule?
No, Your Honor, I think it's not.
Because you gave away the critical defense the insurer has, right? Choice of law.
No, Your Honor, did not. What happened is, and I think it's interesting to note that because the court asked questions about collusion, is that this wasn't Sonat's idea. CUD comes to us and says, we've got a deal for you.
Right, and the deal ends the insurer's best defense.
I think not, Your Honor. What
defense do they have better than Louisiana law makes this clause unenforceable?
I think the primary driver, Your Honor, is they read your opinion in Chesapeake and said, once you read that opinion, that fight's over. Once you read Chesapeake, you find out that Louisiana law is not going to apply to this case.
Of course, that was just the measly 14th Court of Appeals. That was... While well written, that's not necessarily fine.
Well, it was well written, Your Honor, and how revered is the 14th Court of Appeals at this court level, certainly more so than some other appellate courts that we could talk about. But if you look at the logic of that opinion, and when that court and the author went through all the factors that you got to look through in the restatement in 187 and 188, and then Section 6, there wasn't a whole lot left that CUD was going to get to argue about at the Court of Appeals. And so they're faced with this. We've got a loser on our hands under Chesapeake. I'm being sued that I might, in fact, have to pay some money out of my own pocket. So why not take advantage of Sonat? We'll get them to drop that lawsuit against us, which apparently now, even according to Mr. Landry, we can't get back. It's just gone. And we'll drop out a loser out of our appeal. And I'm going to take the top three issues that I have, which are better than the choice of law question, each one of which would call for a reverse and rendition of the case, because I don't want to go back and face the jury again, because this time the verdict might be higher.
If it was such a loser, why were you willing to give up a lawsuit, a valuable right?
I made such a bad deal, Your Honor. I made a terrible deal. Had I to do all over again, I would never do it. I would be through the Court of Appeals in Texarkana and well on my way here with that issue having decided in my favor. But at the time, I'm thinking, well, certainty's better than uncertainty. I can get that clutter out of the case. We can take.
Well, if it's such a loser, why don't you concede and go on back to the Texarkana? Why are you fighting the intervention so hard?
Because the policy, Your Honor, that they want this court to institute is so bad. And let me get to that. Here's what happens. In any case, as this court well knows, as it goes up on appeal, parties have got to decide what issues are going to go to the Court of Appeals or indeed to this court. There are deals made every day between the time of judgment and the time the briefs are written to the appellate court about what issues are actually going to go up. Let me give you some examples of what could happen at the level if, in fact, you're going to allow the intervention to take place. Plaintiff sues defendant for negligence and gross negligence. Plaintiff wins, and they get a verdict on both negligence and gross negligence. It's a close case. The defendant, which now doesn't have any insurance coverage for gross negligence, comes to the plaintiff and he says, look, I'll make this deal with you. I want to appeal liability if you will give up gross negligence. I'll only take up the damage question because, A, I think I can beat that, and two, I'm going to protect myself. And the parties agree, and then the insurance company comes in at the appellate level and says, well, fine, you've given up gross negligence, plaintiff, now, but now let me get into the case because I now want to appeal the liability portion of the case.
What would be the problem with that if there's no evidence of liability? And, you know, there's a take nothing judgment, and the insurer comes in and says, we can save you, you know, the whole case. There's a good reversal and rendition point that you're missing here.
Because what you're going to foster then, Your Honor, is there's never going to be a case in which you can ever narrow down the appellate issues by one side giving up an issue if the other side gives up another issue.
Well, but the insurance company has the right to control the defense. They have a contractual right. And once the insured dumps the insurance company and agrees on appeal, how do they regain that contractual right to control the appeal?
They have exactly what Justice Kilgarland said in Continental Casualty, Your Honor, is that they have a lawsuit against their insured. They can go say, non-cooperation, you breached the contract,
Why do we want to encourage proliferation of litigation and possibly inconsistent results when the real purse holder here has the opportunity to intervene at the appellate court and get the issue resolved all at once? Where if we accept your position, we're saying, okay, you buy a declaratory judgment action plus potential bad faith litigation and potentially conflicting results. Why would we force that on the judicial system?
Well, I think it's just a balancing of the policy. What do you want to do? Do you want to, in fact, have parties being able to narrow the issues and get those issues that really matter before the Court of Appeals, or do you, in fact, want to have what actually probably will never happen is a lawsuit between the insurance company and its insured? But those lawsuits happen all the time. Insurance companies have that right now.
How do we know you're just narrowing the issues rather than deciding between the two litigants would like the insurance company to pay for this one? I mean, you can't narrow the issues that way. That's what Gandy says. You can't narrow the issues before judgment by both deciding the defendant, the insured, saying, I'm going to confess judgment so my insurer can pay for it. And we said you can't do that.
And that's certainly not what happened.
So why is it you can do it after judgment, but not you can not narrow the issues before judgment, but you can afterwards?
Well, narrowing the issues in the Gandy case, Your Honor, is, as you pointed out, confessing judgment. That's not what happened here. Cut is going up on appeal asking the Court of Appeals to reverse and render the case on what it feels, obviously, is its best three issues.
Well, if the insured had stipulated in the trial court, Texas law applies, Louisiana law does not, wouldn't the insurance company have had a right to intervene at that point and say,
yes,
wait
ma'am.
A minute, you stipulated me out of the case. I mean, if you stipulate now that I'm liable, why is it any different now that we're in the appellate court?
Well, two reasons, Your Honor, is that number one, now you have Sonat in the position where he has given up a valuable right of a lawsuit against Cut, which it can never get back. And number two, there's a rule that this court writes that says you have a right to intervene in the trial court if you're a party at interest, and you can apply for permission. It can be struck. The trial court's got wide discretion. But there is no such rule for an intervention at the appellate level. This court has decided.
There's no rule that bans it, prohibits it either.
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be like saying there is no Rule 60. If there is no Rule 60, I doubt you could have an intervention at the trial court level. This court has said in its rules, if you want to get into a lawsuit, you've either got to be a plaintiff and sue somebody, you've got to be a defendant, or you've got to petition the court to intervene, and you write a rule that governs that. The court has exactly the same power to write a rule of intervention at the appellate level, but apparently this court has decided not to do that.
But counsel, even your description of the facts of this case and the issues that we're considering today suggest this is an extraordinary situation. Why should we not consider extraordinary remedies?
Because I think, Your Honor, it's not extraordinary at all.
Even your description sounds like it's a very unique situation. There's a lot at stake. The situation of the parties changed after judgment and after the appeal had begun. It sounds unique and extraordinary to me.
Let me point two things out. Is that number one, I think parties all the time make agreements about what's going to go up on appeal. For example, Cut itself has to decide, of the 15 points that I put in my notion for new trial, am I going to take all 15 to the Court of Appeal, or am I going to take my best three? And I think any experienced appellate lawyer will tell you, I'm going to take my best shot on my best issues, and I'm not going to dilute those issues by having 10 or 12 more that aren't as strong, that takes up my briefing space and doesn't allow me to make full argument to the Court of Appeals. In that situation, Cud could decide, and in fact did decide, that the choice of law having read Justice Brister's opinion in Chesapeake, is not a good issue for me. I'm going to take my best issues up, and by the way, I'm going to get something out of Sonat after having made that decision. Number two, I think this court recognizes that at some juncture you've got to get the issues before the Court of Appeals, and its rule is, as I understand it at least, that the petitioner of the Court of Appeals has to put it all in the first brief. Here's what we're going to encourage. CUD chooses its best three issues, and let's assume for a moment there's no deal with Sonat, and it says my top three issues are the top three issues it put in its brief to the Court of Appeals in Texarkana. We reply. Now the insurance company says, based upon the ruling of this court, wait a minute. You know, I like a whole bunch of other issues. So now, after all the briefing is through, I'm going to intervene, and I've got 12 more issues because the court said I might be affected, and these are pretty good issues. And so what we're going to have is, number one, no chance to narrow the issues down between the parties going up to the Court of Appeals, and now an explosion of briefs at the Court of Appeals by the insurance company that says, I didn't like those issues. I've now seen all the briefs. I don't like how it's come out. So I'm now going to expand that brief, and I'm now going to put these other 12 issues
in. You agree that, at least potentially, depending on how a court determines the law, that a conflict may result in the insurer not being responsible for this judgment. Is that correct? Through a deck action or some other procedure?
Yes, sure.
What practically happens here when a supersedious bond is posted? How does that, I mean, will the plaintiff execute and then the insurer attempt to recover that if there's a determination that there is no coverage? I mean, how does this, unravel itself?
Well, I think the way it unravel is this. Assuming we were to win at the Court of Appeals and win at this court on the issues that are before the court, and we were to be able to collect our judgment, we could, in fact, collect on the supersedious bond. And then the insurance company would have a action against its insured for non-cooperation or whatever those policy violations might have been, and they could recover their money from their insured.
But, all right, so you all get to keep the $29 million.
I would hope so.
Whatever happens.
Right.
If we win, that's correct, Your Honor.
What happens under the scenario if the insurer is defending a case on a reservation of rights issue, in cases it results in a judgment against the insured, and there's an appeal, and on appeal the insurer decides to settle that case within the limits that it has, but exposes your client to perhaps an excess of some amount in excess of their policy that's not covered. Would you have a right to intervene then? In essence, the roles would be reversed.
And I think the answer is no, Your Honor. I think not. You could also have this situation, though. Let's suppose for a moment that in this case or any case, that the insured has insurance up to, say, $5 million, and the judgment is for $4 million. And now there's an appeal, and the same situation exists. And the insurance company now says, well, you know what? I'm out $4 million. I don't like that. I don't like the fact that my insured has given up what I think to be good appellate issues, whether it was a deal or whether they just didn't put them in their brief. And so now, under the Supreme Court's ruling, I'm going to intervene. And they, in fact, intervene, and they get the case reversed and sent back for a new trial. And at the new trial, the judgment's not $4 million, but it's $14 million. And the insurance company says, well, good try. Here's the $5 million. You, by the way, insured, you're on your own for the other nine. At some juncture, the insured has some rights to determine what it, A, wants to take to the Court of Appeals, and B, it can protect itself from a judgment in which it either can't pay or shouldn't be required to pay by making decisions that may infect the insurance company, but they paid for that policy. And if the insurance company didn't like it, they could have intervened at the trial court level and gotten out in front of the jury, which they're not going to do, to prevent that. Or they can say, well, they paid their premiums, and that's what happened. But it should not be to the detriment of the insured that they're allowed to intervene. And in this case, it should not be to the detriment of Sonat that gave up a case based upon good faith negotiations with CUD. There's no collusion.
I think that's a good analysis, and I like that response. What I'm wrestling with, and I think perhaps some other
others may be, is how this does not, how Gandy doesn't apply to this situation. I know you hit on it a couple of times, but I'm not persuaded that Gandy doesn't apply here.
Well, if I remember the Gandy facts right, Your Honor, there was in fact a confession of judgment. There was a judgment given up at the trial court level. Here, nothing of the sort took place. And the insured can make its own decision. It did. What issues do I have the best chance of winning on at the Court of Appeals?
I understand that, but from this record, it appears that an agreement was reached at the expense of the insurer after the judgment was entered. So well, we have a post-judgment.
Your Honor, it would only be at the expense of the insurance company if, in fact, they were... that Cut is wrong about its appeal, and two, the insurance company would be right that the Chesapeake case is wrong and that either this court or some other court is going to overturn that opinion, which I think is highly unlikely. It was not, and is not, likely going to affect the case one way or the other. That's why.
But you wouldn't say the rule was any different if Chesapeake had come out the other way. You'd still say this should, that you should not be allowed to intervene.
I would say that, Your Honor.
So it doesn't have anything to do with whether you thought it was a good issue or a bad issue. You think the party can give it up if it wants to.
Well, Your Honor, I think what it has to do with, though, is what the court, I think, is apparently wrestling with, is that was there some collusion? And there was not collusion.
Well, as I asked earlier, whether you call it that or not, the party who stands to pay the tab is not going to have an argument made that it wants to have made. That was the bottom line problem again. It's the bottom line problem here.
And that is true, Your Honor. And of course, they've got two remedies. If they wanted to insure, well, they actually have three. If they wanted to ensure that wouldn't happen, they can write their insurance contract. This is excess insurance. They could have written any contract they wanted that said, if I'm going to give you insurance, not only can I control the litigation, but I'm going to control what your brief looks like. They can put that in every excess insurance policy they want.
You say that the insurer may have a suit against the insured after you win and recover. Do you think in that suit that the insurer, to recover against its insured, would have to prove that it would have won on this argument if the argument had been made? Surely it couldn't just win because the argument was given up. Surely it would have to.
I think that would be right, Your Honor. I think it'd be almost like a malpractice case where you'd have to prove that but for the malpractice of the lawyer, you would have won the case. I think that same test would apply.
That raises the other problem in Gandy, is that in that case, then, Cudd has to argue that Texas law would have applied, which it never wanted to do until it got on appeal. And so the people will be taking positions that they never wanted to take, but now they have to take in order to win.
Your Honor, I know it's not in the record, but actually Cudd had argued that Texas law ought to apply both at the trial court levels when it was a defendant, as it was in the initial cases. Cudd, in fact, argued that Texas law ought to apply. It shouldn't be any shock to their insured, and their insurer was right there with them at that time, apparently, that Texas law applied. They, in fact, argued that. And in fact, Texas law does apply. Let me say one more thing. I would disagree, and my time is up, Your Honor, but I would disagree that the insurance company can avail itself of the doctrine of virtual representation. They, in fact, are not bound by the judgment, and they certainly can't meet the third prong of the test as enumerated in Continental Casualty. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Justice Ellen and you, Justice Brister, put your finger right on the point here, which is the argument that the choice of law issue is a loser and therefore was simply just given up is belied by what we've submitted, which shows that the courts in Louisiana have reached exactly the same exactly the opposite conclusion on the same case, involving the same contracts, involving an insurer in the identical position of Lumbermans. That insurer left the state of Texas, crossed the state lines, went to Louisiana, and got a declaratory judgment that it owes no coverage and has no indemnity obligation.
Let me ask you.
It's gone.
How many times has this court
granted mandamus relief without finding that a lower court abused its discretion?
I knew we'd come back to that, Your Honor, and I can't cite you to an indication of that. It would have to be either an abuse of discretion or a denial of a legal duty. Our argument simply, it goes back to the principle of the way the system is supposed to work. We have a right. We should be entitled to a remedy.
So would we be changing the mandamus standard in this case?
No, Your Honor, we would simply
say... So what's the abuse of discretion?
Well, the abuse of discretion is in refusing to allow an unnamed party to the appeal with a right at stake to appear in its own name to defend its interests.
And they've always had that right in Texas.
I believe the parties whose rights are at stake and whose property can be taken have the right to appear in the court system and defend that property, protect their interests.
But you have a remedy. It's not as good a remedy as you would like to have. I mean, you might have to pay out on the bond and then assert a conflict of interest and get it back from the insurer, but there is a remedy. It's just not your favorite remedy.
Well, agreed, Your Honor, because I think it stores up further more problems than any of the scenarios that we present.
It's a more problematic remedy.
Not just here, for the future. Mr. Baxter suggests that an insurer can put in its policy, not only will we control the defense, but we'll decide what's in your brief. Can an insurer put in its policy, and we have the right to compel you to take a position on our behalf that will expose you to an uninsured judgment? I've never seen a case in any 50 of the 50 states that gives an insurer a right to compel its insured to do that under penalty of loss of coverage. Never. So that being the case, what you would be encouraging is, as Mr. Baxter wisely points out, in every scenario that they present, they walk away with the $29 million. That's given. Even though they, by the way, are also our insured. But they get the $29 million. And then we have to fight out with our insured and prove that the insured acted in collusion in seeking to protect its interests and try to collect that $29 million back from our insured.
Which is a remedy. Maybe not a great one, but it's a remedy.
I can't believe, well, Your Honor, I simply do not believe that the law would want to encourage that sort of thing to being done here.
Is Cut a big enough company to be worth $29 million, collect $29 million?
Your Honor, I don't know. I really don't know. And as you say, I don't know that, again, I don't know that we could hope to prove collusion. This is not, as Mr. Baxter wisely points out, this wasn't a confession of judgment case. Cudd defended the case in accordance with Lumberman's shared interests all the way through. What happened is that there is a contingent case, not an excess exposure in this case. There is another case coming down the line. And that's one of the other reasons that we're here.
Let me ask you, would we be changing the law of representation if we do not allow a party with $29 million at stake to get involved in the litigation?
I believe you would be, Your Honor, because although I recognize that the Continental Casualty case did not have to specifically decide whether an insurer is virtually represented by its insured, I think that clearly it must be. That's the only explanation in a non-direct action statute state that I understand how an insurer's interest can be protected. The other point, basically what I'm hearing Sonnet saying is we made a deal. And it just so happens, Lumbermans, that this deal that we made prefits you for the noose. And you just don't have any right to come in here and try to pull your head out, is what is being said. And they're saying there was no collusion here. They're attesting to the fact that there was no collusion here. And I don't know where the insurer on a later collusion trial would come up with evidence that there was collusion.
You were getting ready to say something about something else is coming down the line. Would you finish that?
And that's another point that I think is critical. There are still pending in the district court what is called the insurance coverage lawsuit. This was the indemnity claim. Sonnet has a second claim against Lumbermans directly. And in that case, the district court has issued a summary ruling that Sonnet is an additional insured under our policy and that Texas law applies. Now, that will translate into a judgment because there is a basis for all that's left to be tried on the court's order is damages. When Lumbermans appeals that judgment, it would like to assign as error the district court's choice of law ruling in that case. Two things will happen. Either Lumberman succeeds in that appeal, in which case the $29 million in this case will have been forfeited under an error of law, or Sonnet comes in and takes the position, you're barred by collateral estoppel. That issue's already been litigated up there in the indemnity claim, in which, by the way, you did not have the right or the chance to appear.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions? I thank the court. That concludes this argument, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.